Thanks, Toby.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Mia Mask. I'm a professor of film at Vassar College.
and Vassar College is in the United States in
Yep.
upstate New York.
It is. Vassar is in the Hudson Valley. So we are about 80 miles up the Hudson. We are at that midpoint between New York City and Albany. So Poughkeepsie was for many years a kind of hub or a place where there were meetings for various businesses and commercial operations because it was this meeting point between Albany, the state capital, and New York City, its financial capital. And there are a number of colleges here, obviously Vassar, but also Bard College and community colleges as well. And then, of course, New Paltz, SUNY New Paltz is just across the river.
State University of New York. Now, Prof, you grew up in Brooklyn. Here's a tough question for you, but I didn't warn you about. How old were you when you first learned how to pronounce Poughkeepsie?
Oh, that's a great question. I was in my 30s
Me
when I
too.
okay. Yeah, it was after I got the Poughkeepsie, you know, the job here and moved to Poughkeepsie because I was like, "Po what?" You know, but there are many of these Native American named sort of towns, and I also learned that kill is, you know, in some Native American languages, is the way you talk about stream or river. So we have fish kill, wall kill, which is really a way of talking about all the little streams and estuaries that are in and around this area. So there are many Native American names that still, thankfully, grace the landscape.
Yes, I mean, that's the other side to one's linguistic infelicity with pronouncing some things that are not very well transcribed into English.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it's just as a side note, I mean, down in Florida, there are all of these little towns like Okeechobee and Lackahatchee, and I was down there visiting and they made fun of Poughkeepsie. And I was like, come on, you've got some pretty elaborate names and towns down here as well. Well, so.
Well, I was born in a town spelt Leicester.
Leicestershire? No.
Leicester, you got it. But
Leicester. Oh, Leicester.
It's next to somewhere spelled Lougbrough.
Loughborough? No.
Pretty good. Loughborough.
Okay.
But my favorite is one not very far away, which is spelled Mousehole, like mouse hole.
I was going to say, like, mouse hole, there's something too deceptively, like, easy. How do you
Yeah.
pronounce it, though?
Muzzle.
Ah,
Like on a
okay.
horse. Anyway,
Right.
sorry, Prof. We've got limited time with you. Why am I testing you on pronunciation?
I don't mind at all.
So it's a great privilege and honor to be with you. And I wanted to start forgetting about this silly little game, although quite interesting one about how to pronounce Poughkeepsie, by asking you what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, concerning, interesting you.
Well, thank you for the question, Toby, and thank you so much for inviting me to be part of the community of podcast listeners and to be on today. It's an honor and a pleasure. You've been such an inspiration to so many of us who were your students. So what's preoccupying me right now? No, I really appreciate the question. Right now, I have been very preoccupied with my new book, Black Rodeo, History of the African American Western. And yes, many people have said to me, wait, there are Black Westerns? That, and they followed up with, there are enough Black Westerns to write a whole book about them? And I've been, you know, I've chuckled and had to say yes. And in fact, I don't cover all of them in my book because how could I? But there are. And I became interested in this project from the work that I had been doing in cinema studies, having been trained in cinema studies, but also in cultural studies and the broader questions that came to mind when looking at African American Western. So just from the cinema standpoint, there really hadn't been or film history standpoint, there really hadn't been an analysis of, a compendium of Black Westerns, going from the sort of early days of the 20s and 30s to the present. I realized I had to come up with a project that was a little bit more precise and concise than that. So my book's really looking at 1950s Westerns to the present. And I found that there are many African American actors who were appearing in Westerns. Some of them were football stars that turned to acting, like Woody Strode or Jim Brown or Fred Williamson. And there are others. I mean, even Richard Roundtree played football for a time, but that there were several of those that were preceded or were contemporaries with Sidney Poitier, who made his directorial debut in the Western genre. Obviously, he had been in many other Westerns and films beforehand. But I was interested in the figure of the cowboy for many reasons. He's a sort of palimpsest, if you will, or a figure upon which a lot is sort of transcribed and written. And we could read him as kind of symbolic or metonymic of many different things. I think that the cowboy in American popular culture, it occupies an important space in the sort of popular imaginary because people look at the cowboy as essential to Americana, as essential to the myths we tell ourselves about how the West was won, how this na the nation was formed. You know, he's at the center of nation and narration, right? How we have imagined this country forming, not necessarily how it has actually been formed. And so that, I think, is one reason he's important. He's also an important iconic figure because he is at the center of this contest over who is an American, who gets to be considered of an American, who is entitled to citizenship, right? And entitled to the American dream. And I still think that's true today. And I think it's playing itself out today in popular culture in terms of music. Look at the debate, and I'll wind down in a sec, but look at the debate right now over American popular music with Beyoncé recording Texas Hold'em and the contest that has emerged over her right to engage in Western, music practices. And unfortunately, the flip side of that is there are many African American artists who've been recording country music for a long time, and Beyoncé eclipses some of those. Even Lil Nas X recorded Old Town Road before she recorded Texas Hold'em. But all of that aside, I think we're still seeing this contest over who gets to be an American played out through through the figure of the cowboy in the popular imagination. So that's taken up a lot of space for me. Thank you for the question.
You know, it reminds me of in the mid 70s when Olivia Newton-John, who was a white sort of Anglo-Australian singer, won
Yes.
Country Music Entertainer of the Year. This was prior to the making of Grease. And she was awarded Carpetbagger of the Year
Oh, wow.
by the right. And for those who
Which
don't know this, the Carpetbagger is the damned figure for the fast white southern right in the United States of the capitalist figure from the Northeast who makes money from the tragedy, in inverted commas, of the loss of the Civil War. So for those of you who unfortunately have watched Gone with the Wind, Clark Gable is the figure of the carpetbagger. Would that be fair to say, Prof?
Absolutely. Great characterization. He's supposed to represent the sort of northern upstarts who have, come and are sweeping in and taking over and taking control, sort of usurpers, if you will.
Yeah. And of course, it's after the Civil War that the whole fantasy of country and Western develops as part of the attack on Reconstruction. Right. So it's interesting that this sort of heritage is protected 50 years ago from a white woman who comes from another country and is still the object of a desire to possess and exclude in the second quarter of the 21st century.
Absolutely. And then, as you know, the airwaves and that sort of separation of who gets to record, who gets to listen to, and how music gets branded and marketed was very strategic. You're absolutely right.
Also interesting in that I recorded a podcast only last week with someone who works with Indigenous people in Australia on radio and their interest in US country music, in part black country music, but country music in general, because a bit like some Mexican music. It's about loss and failure and alcohol and romantic disaster. And so there was something there that people could read across racial and national lines.
Yes, and what you're saying, Toby, is so accurate because country music has at its heart the blues. It is really informed by the American blues tradition. So all of the themes that you just listed really originate or have their genesis in blues rhythms, blues music, and to some extent Negro spirituals. So what the irony is, as you know, is that blues and country music really come out of an African American tradition and African American idioms and then evolve into country music. It doesn't surprise me that it's quite popular in Australia. I'm learning more myself about Westerns in the Global South, Westerns in South Africa, Westerns in Oceania in general, and finding that these idioms have a presence there and have a genealogy there.
Well, there are even some Native Americans who have found something interesting in the genre of the Western, which is so directly aimed at trying to erase their existence in the name of a kind of Frederick Jackson Turner fantasy of US history.
Right. And there are all of those revisionist Westerns that have flipped the script. Not only the Native American ones you mentioned, but I feel like implicit in your comment are those sort of Karl May inspired German or sauerkraut Westerns that flipped the script, right? Yeah. Coming out of those adventure novels by Karl May that were adapted, but that definitely flipped the script and imagine the kind of sympathy for the Native Americans. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, one of the ways that your wonderful writing in this latest book really carries the reader is your description of growing up and loving horses,
Yes.
and how difficult it was to find a convenient place to stable a horse, to ride a horse, to rent a horse, whatever experience it was, and the requirement to go to Staten Island and all that would have entailed in terms of space and everything else, cultural difference. But just the distance that you and your dad had to travel, would you write about to get there on his like one afternoon off a week or whatever in his job, I think. And but you managed to bring us as readers from that personal anecdote about being an urban rider to think about why horses disappeared from the middle of US cities, and then onto how the connection between Black America and horses disappeared from the historiography,
Yes.
from both availability but also knowledge, through violence, and theft, also through historical denial. So I wonder if maybe you could tell us a little bit about you and horses,
Sure.
and also about that jump that you make.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so appreciative that you like that story. You're the second person to tell me that they really like the introduction and that I begin with this personal anecdote about my father and I and my riding. I was a little worried or trepidatious about incorporating that in the book because I was like, well, this isn't really relevant. People might not care, but I'm glad that the connection worked for you.
At
Yeah.
least two of us care.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it's early days. I have to talk to more people, but yeah. Yes, so absolutely. I think it has been a function to some extent of dispossession, right? It to in that well, let me back up and say, as you know from the book, I started riding as a kid and have loved horses my whole life. I still ride. And yeah, I believe it or not, but here in the Hudson Valley in New York, we have lots of farms. I joke that you can't throw a stone without hitting a barn up here because there are lots of people who have horses, whether as riding horses or as lawn ornaments. Some people keep them as pets mostly, yeah, which is, fine too. But I love to ride, and I think that it's important to recognize that having access to land, having access to space to maintain and to keep one's livestock or animals is an essential part of what we consider to be the American dream, or access to full citizenship. It is on one's family farm, on one's own plot of land, that one has and carves out a life for oneself. And we see this, interestingly enough, even today in contemporary politics, with these various politicians talking about, certainly on the right in the US, talking about their political identity through the landscape, right? And how a connection to the landscape, whether it be in South Dakota, right, or elsewhere, is part of one's identity. So I think it's so important that we remember that. And what African Americans, through slavery, through labor, have put into the land, and the reneging of the United States government on the promise of 40 acres and a mule in the Reconstruction era, right? That was a step towards reparations that was not fulfilled. And so, as a consequence, we still see the impact, the financial or economic impact of that divestment, of that that appropriation, that failure to make good on a certain kind of reparations for African Americans. And I think it has contributed to the wealth gap, because there is a tremendous wealth gap in this country, which is partially, I would argue, partially attributable to land ownership. So that history of dispossession has preoccupied me. And also, I believe, has informed people's inability to cultivate their own land, to have animals, and to engage in all kinds of leisure activities on which and for which land is necessary. So I guess I'm saying it has an economic component as well as a social component, this sort of loss of land and loss of real estate. Is that sort of where you wanted me to go into
Yes,
the question?
absolutely. But there's something else, which is the evisceration of this story from the histories.
Yes,
And it
yes.
seems to me there's a homology here between the absence of this from conventional US histories, just as there is an absence of the African American Western from
Yes.
the conventional history of the Western.
Precisely. So brilliant, Professor Miller. I so appreciate you, because you made that connection. Yes, because what I'm saying is, by eliminating that history in, and taking it away from the history books, you kind of undermine the actual contribution that African Americans and other peoples of color, and Native peoples, have made to the formation of this nation, right? And you eviscerate it from his history, but also from the popular culture, or the that mythologization of history. And in eviscerating it, you can then reclaim who is an American, who's participated in the formation of the nation, and rewrite that conversation, that history, that discourse, and eliminate some people from that, and thereby doubly enact a kind of erasure, or sort of eradication, evisceration of them from the notion of citizenship, right? And so it's, to me, it's part of a discourse on citizenship.
And in terms of the genre, why is the African American Western missing from the mythology?
In terms of the genre, you say?
The history of the genre, let's call it, perhaps would be better to say the historiography of the genre.
Sure. Well, it's now reemerging. And I would say it is missing in part because of the way we initially began to talk about the Great Migration. So we first, in our work, in the scholarly work being produced, by both African American and mainstream scholars began to look at the Great Migration and Black modernity through our experiences in urban environments. So the migration from plantations to Detroit, Chicago, New York, and Pittsburgh, and understanding Black modernity through the lens of our experience in those cities, right? And how we became modern subjects through idioms and practices and cultural practices in and techniques of the self and regimes of the self in those urban environments. We were less preoccupied, less interested in talking about Black modernity as it emerged from the through that migration from the South and particularly Louisiana out west to Colorado, to California, and to Washington State. But now a lot of folks are looking at it more carefully, more deeply, and drawing connections between the timber industry in Washington State and the formation of towns and cities out west and the formation of towns in Colorado. So I would argue that it was partially disciplinary and the historiography was written in a particular way through migration narratives, through an understanding of the Great Migration, as we understand it through northern cities.
Makes a lot of sense. And in terms of your doing your own research for this new book, how did you do it? I mean, you thank the Schomburg Center, amongst others, in your book, but where were you able to gain access to the Black Western as a genre?
Well, as you say, the Schomburg Center, but also the Library of Congress, because this book began in some ways when I was still doing work on Divas on Screen, Black Women in American Film, which was my first book, and as you know, developed out of my dissertation, was the dissertation that then became a book manuscript. And I was at the Library of Congress. And it was there that I was looking through the catalog at African American films and came upon this phantom orchid called Black Rodeo. And I was like, Black Rodeo? What is that? It sounds like it must have horses in it, right? So I'm like, I have to find out what this is. And sure enough, it was this documentary made by Jeff Canoe, released in 1972. He was just a young independent filmmaker at the time, and it documented cinema verite style. It documented a traveling rodeo, an all-black traveling rodeo. And I had was I had never heard of this. You know, it was such a fascinating kind of story, and I'd never seen anything like it on film. I also teach documentary history and theory, so I was like, this could be a film for my course. And so, in looking at that film, I said, wow, there is so much here that one could examine from a cinema studies standpoint, but also from sort of a filmmaking standpoint, as well as a kind of understanding of nation and narration. And I say that because some of the subjects interviewed talked about, and these were just lay people on the street in Harlem, because the film is shot in Harlem. It takes place on Randall's Island and in Harlem. And these are just lay people walking around saying, yeah, it's great to see these black cowboys because we were out in the West too. You don't see that on TV. So they were fascinatingly articulate about the absence of African Americans from this history, from this historiography of the Black West, of the American West, and of American history. So that film was a big turning point for me. So the Library of Congress, the Schomburg, I would say I was beginning to just scour all the different archives that I could for which ones had Western films. There were some films that I did not include. I, as I said, don't look at some of the earliest Black Westerns, The Silence, for example, but I thought that the book would begin to become a bit too sprawling. But that gives you a sense. It was some of the major archives.
And you mentioned Sidney Poitier in terms of his directorial debut. You co-edited a book on Sydney, Poitiers.
Yeah.
And perhaps we could talk a little bit about that book. And
Yeah.
then I want to go back, as they say in baseball commentary, and talk about Divas on Screen.
Sure, no, I
Okay.
appreciate that. And that's a great way for me to segue from Black Rodeo to the Poitiers book, because I think Black Rodeo, finding it at the Library of Congress was one of the first sort of points of departure or sort of sparks for me. The other was my long-term interest in Sidney Poitier. I've long been interested in Black stardom and in the contradictions implicit in Black celebrity. And he's been a seminal figure for me for a long time. And I found out that one of the first films he directed, that Sidney Poitier directed, was Buck and the Preacher. And he wasn't scheduled to direct this film, but it was something that he sort of wrestled away from Joseph Sargent, the initial director who was scheduled to direct the picture. And I decided to start researching Buck and the Preacher. And in that process, learned that there was the Sidney Poitier International Film Festival and Conference happening in Nassau, Bahamas. And that's a place from which, yes, exactly, where he was born. And he still has his family there. And so we convened, and it was really a wonderful, almost international conference, not of a tremendous number of scholars, but group of dedicated Poitier scholars getting together. And Mr. Poitier was still alive at the time. We were fortunate enough to have him kind of do a version of a Zoom call in to convene with us and answer some of our questions. And we asked him, Mr. Poitier, of all the films you have made or appeared in, which is your favorite? And Toby, I have to tell you, I just nearly jumped for joy when he said Buck and the Preacher was his favorite film. And of course, he went on to explain, I know, right? I was like, woo, happy me. But he went on to explain that it was his directorial debut, and it was the film that also enabled him to achieve politically in the cinema some of the things he wanted to achieve, which was to dignify Native Americans, which was to put across a message of collaboration and resistance in the bond formed between African Americans and Native Americans that he depicts in that film. And in he said sort of presenting Native American people with a kind of dignity that they hadn't been given in the cinema. And so for him, it was one of his personal favorite films. So that conference went really well. And out of that conference, we sought to put together an anthology, which became Poitier Revisited, Reconsidering a Black Icon in the Obama Age, and was published by Bloomsbury in 2014.
And it doesn't have nearly enough about To Sir With Love, but that's okay.
You're right. You're right. We need more. That needs its own anthology.
Well, it's
All
just that
right.
he's such a well, I mean, he has such an incredible body of work,
Yes.
and it's a film with all sorts of flaws, but it was my introduction to him. I was about 8 or 9 when it came out, and it really spoke to me because I had just come out of a school that was a little bit different from the one that he was teaching at, but not that different. And it was really a remarkable film for me, but an extraordinarily versatile actor and someone who was a huge star internationally, absolutely enormous, and could carry a film on his own.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I'm just happy that he's someone whose career has now begun to be appreciated. When I was first interested in him and began the work for my chapter on him and on Bucking the Preacher, he was still really a contested figure. People were still talking about Poitier as a sellout. funny as as kind of the Uncle Tom figure who was too accommodating, too assimilating to white society, white social norms, and he gained this reputation in part as a result of his appearance in films like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and even as early as 1958 with the Defiant Ones and with Tony Curtis, which was a great role. It's a brilliant film, but was a film that was contested in some ways by audiences. So he wasn't quite appreciated, but I'm so happy that people really are reevaluating his oeuvre, if you will, and see the complexity and depth in his films. And you're so right when you say that To Sir with Love, I talk to more and more people who are like, growing up, that was such an important, meaningful film for me. I was a teenager or a preteen and going through many of the same things. And one woman told me I had such a crush on him, when I was a teenager. So yeah, it's a really important film. It's interesting, also a film in which there's a little bit of a role reversal for him, because he had played in Blackboard Jungle the liminal or sort of outsider who was misrecognized by the teacher as the class delinquent. And so in To Sir with Love, here he is as the teacher struggling with a group of kids, but he really is very meaningful in their lives.
And he's prepared to be the angry black man.
Yes,
And I think
yes.
sometimes the critiques of Poitier leave out
Yes.
the fact that he can show a fairly controlled rage as an angry black man. That is, for people who've not lived in the United States, it's one of the great taboos of
Yes.
white supremacist culture, that
Yeah.
black men, the angry black man, must be stopped, killed,
Yes.
imprisoned,
Contain. Yep.
contained at all
Contain.
costs, right?
Yeah. You're so right. No, thank you for saying that. It's so true. I mean, I was about to say from the earliest days of cinema, but really even before cinema, right? Black male characters on stage and then on screen had to be contained because they supposedly represented the threat of violence to white society, the threat of sexual violence against white women, right? And so we get all of the sort of ugly tropes that can't come out of films like The Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith. And obviously there's Donald Bogle's wonderful book, Toms, Coons, Mammies, Mulattoes, and Bucks, right, in which he catalogs the racial stereotypes to which African Americans had been limited for so many years in early cinema. And it one of the problems is that black men were either contained by the fact that they were made comical, or they had to die, be lynched, be hunted and executed, right, in so many of those films. But as you say, Toby, it was such a moment of change when Poitier could be angry in movies. And people forget that he got angry in a lot of early films. 1961, A Raisin in the Sun. He gave a brilliant performance on stage and then on film as angry at white supremacy, as angry at white people specifically. And I emphasize that because that was the anger, right, that was the most threatening, right? Being angry with white people, the white power structure, white supremacy. But you get that in early films, in some of his earlier pictures. But that was considered taboo, and he did it well.
So before we go on to divas on screen, I wanted to go back to something you said about other male leads in black cowboy films. And you mentioned that people like Woody Strode and Jim Brown and Richard Roundtree and so
Yes.
on had been athletes.
Mm-hmm.
There are so few routes towards a black middle class in the United States. They're growing all the time. There are more and more people who are accountants and dentists and lawyers and doctors and professors and judges and so on. But historically, popular culture, including sports, was some sort of route. But here, what we find is a movement between the two, with the black male body as excellent at sports then becoming an actor. But often, in many of the roles those guys played, and it doesn't only happen to black men, the black body that gets injured, wounded, killed, think of
Maimed.
maimed. Jim Brown in The Dirty Dozen is a kind of classic, gratuitous killing. Not a relevant film for your book, but I think very typical. And if you start to look at how black people die on screen in Hollywood, historically, it's astounding how regularly there are gratuitous deaths. I mean, it shouldn't be astounding, but you know what I mean. So I wondered if you could
Oh,
reflect
absolutely.
on the fact that in so many films, black sports people become Hollywood stars, even if they're not exactly A-list, per
Sure.
Jim Brown or Woody Strode.
Yes. No, thank you. I so appreciate that question because in my research, I found that there were wonderful articles written in the Black press, for example, like Ebony, Sepia, Our World, some of these fanzines, articles titled Football Heroes Turn Hollywood, And one of the reasons that we see so much, so many folks transitioning from professional sports to film stardom is they had to prove themselves first, or I should say the Hollywood elite, the Hollywood industry and filmmakers were looking for African Americans who had already proved themselves in some other venue as number one, as performers under difficult circumstances and conditions like professional sport, and were representing or could symbolize a certain kind of black masculinity, right? A very a black masculinity that was virile in certain ways, very athletic, muscular, right? A certain almost stereotypical black masculinity. And this brings us back to Poitier, helps make a good connection from Poitier to, say, Jim Brown, for example, or Woody Strode. John Ford wanted an African American actor for Sergeant Rutledge. At the time that he was making, because that film's released in 1960, Sidney Poitier was like the number one black actor in America, or at least on his way to being such. But John Ford did not want to cast Sidney Poitier for the film because he thought Sidney wasn't tough enough. Interestingly, so he picks Woody Strode instead because Woody's so ripped and so buff and so big in terms of muscularity, having played football and rugby and I think other sports, and just being such a buff athlete. And so there was this decision kind of being made on the part of a kind of white establishment within Hollywood that a certain kind of black masculinity needed to be represented. And that's interesting because that does have a corollary within the African American community at this point, but I can come back to that. And so you're right, Toby, when you say there is this almost spectacularity, right? Or this spectacularization of the black body in popular culture, right? That doesn't begin here, but certainly takes on new nuances with this moment, right? And so you see Woody Strode, and then behind him, Jim Brown, who was a very big football star, who then made Rio Concho, 100 Rifles, and other Westerns, El Condor. Then right behind him, almost a contemporary, comes Fred Williamson, right? And right behind him, somebody I don't take up in the book is O.J. Simpson, right? And Richard Roundtree's in that mix. So the reason, to answer one of your questions, the reason you see that is number one, because they wanted a certain kind of black masculinity, but also they wanted people to prove, okay, can you perform? Can you perform under these conditions? And we're also going to leverage some of that celebrity where you've performed in sport, and we're going to use some of that cultural capital and add it to our films. And so that capital that you bring from the sports world will add to the value of this motion picture. And so that's part of why you have that dynamic. But you're asking also a little bit more about Black Pain, right? The spectacularization of that.
Right,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah. I think that it's a great question that has many layers, and I'll just talk about one or two, which is part of what's happening there is once again this way in which the Black body has been imagined, has been created as something that is I don't know, really don't know what the best, extraordinary in some ways, right? That it can take on extraordinary amounts of pain, extraordinary physical tasks. And this is, I think, coming out of the logic of slavery to some extent, right? Like you can justify a certain treatment of a labor force if you can say, well, they're extraordinarily powerful. Inured to pain, or pain is imperceptible to them, so that we can treat these people in a certain way because their bodies are different and allow for this kind of exploitation of their physical labor. And
Think
I think
about
part of
the cops talking about Rodney King after being tasered.
exactly,
He
and I think
just
that
kept coming at me.
keep right, keep cut, and this idea that Black men are somehow a threat that has to be put down, has to be contained, has to be incarcerated, comes out of, I think, this logic out of slavery and out of, sort of this American history, that Black bodies can endure more, and therefore we can treat them certain ways and we can exploit them in certain ways. So I think that there's that whole sort of economic component there, and it informs the logic of how Black bodies have been treated, how Black bodies have been mythologized, and even how they are surveilled.
Now, Prof, we've talked a lot about the guys, so I think we have to move to Divas on Screen,
Sure.
which has chapters on some of my favorite actors of all time, I should say,
Oh, okay.
and is a an earlier book of yours, as you said, based on your dissertation. And I've often struggled with what's a diva.
Right, sure.
So would you help me out with an explanation of the word to
Yeah,
start with?
sure. I came up with that really because I wanted to talk about Black women who felt a certain kind of self-possession, and comfort, and pride, and dignity, beauty in themselves. And again, now that was before, obviously, I'd written the Westerns book, and I was interested in talking about Black women in film. And many people said to me, "There are enough women to write about." It's the same thing, same conversation I had with people when I was writing the Westerns book. There are enough Black women film stars to write a whole book about them, and I was like, "Yeah, there are." So I wanted to say to folks, yes, there are Black women film stars. And so the title and the use of the term diva was also about saying, yes, there are these Black women film stars. And while they may not consider themselves A-list stars the way we consider stars today, that they've had dozens of films like Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn, right? There may not be stars in that kind of traditional Hollywood sense. They were divas in their own right, and divas in the way that they managed, navigated, manipulated, survived the Hollywood infrastructure. And divas became my apparatus, if you will, Toby, for talking about that navigation, right? That manipulation, that negotiation of the Hollywood industry. And so the book is about Dorothy Dandridge, Pam Grier, Whoopi Goldberg, Oprah Winfrey, and Halle Berry as pioneers, if you will, as Black women pioneers who negotiated, navigated the racism, sexism, heterosexism, colorism of Hollywood, and in doing so, survived. And I wouldn't say that they all thrived, but survived and achieved, because they achieved things that Black women had not achieved in cinema before. And for me, that's why they're divas. They're divas because they negotiated, navigated, and survived and achieved things in film that Black women had not achieved before. So I'll go quickly through them. Dorothy Dandridge, being the first Black woman to be nominated for an Academy Award for the film she made with Harry Belafonte, Carmen Jones, based on Bizet's opera. Then, as we get to Pam Grier, her incredible self-possession as a sexual icon in the 70s and her movement from sexploitation to blaxploitation, and just to be that authoritative presence, and to have the longevity that Pam Grier has had. I've had the pleasure and privilege of interviewing her, and she's a riot. Then I would say Whoopi Goldberg. Fascinating comedian who has been able to push the boundaries around gender and sexuality and heteronormativity, and is still out today in, as a media figure and making films. And she just recently appeared in Mario Van Peebles' Outlaw Posse as Stagecoach Mary, which is a new Black Western. And then when we get to Oprah, I mean, Oprah kind of goes without saying. I don't need to explain that. And I think Halle Berry, last but not least, in winning the Academy Award for Monsters Ball. Not that I hold that film up as the end all be all, or that I think the Academy is somehow a arbiter of merit. I do not. I don't even watch the Academy Awards. Haven't watched it in 20 years. And was a big proponent of the boycott movement. But I do think that she achieved something in that and in the complexities and nuances of Monsters Ball. So that's why I use that term diva, long-winded answer. Sorry about that. And for me, that's what the diva sort of signifies.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about these women is that apart from Dorothy Dandridge, where it's hard not to encase her story in the genre of tragedy because she died so young and she suffered so much,
Indeed.
other actors that you write about have had dips in their public circulation. I think of Pam Grier, for example, but have come back and have been able to transcend the problem that women in Hollywood of all cultural backgrounds face, which is you're over 30, see ya. You're over 40, see ya. These people that you list are all women who remained, in some cases remain, stars in their 50s, 60s, and so on. And in one case, Oprah Winfrey, one of the wealthiest people in show business, as a very successful businesswoman. So there's an element here that perhaps relates to being a diva, that is the tenacity as well as the skill that they have shown to survive in one of the more patriarchal industries. And I wondered if you might reflect a little bit on that and how Dandridge is slightly different because of her early death and the fact that the others have big comebacks, let's say, like Halle Berry being a big star and then absent for a while, Pam Grier, a clear case, and having different iterations between the big screen and the small screen.
Thank you. No, it's really a thoughtful question because it reminds me of one of the differences between Dorothy Dandridge and the other women is the feminist movement, right? And the fact that in some ways, second wave feminism created a world and an environment. Alongside the civil rights movement, created a world and an environment where women like Pam Grier could come back and could survive some of the patriarchal challenges that were before them. I think Dorothy Dandridge came in at an earlier age, at an earlier moment,
Yes,
at a
got it.
different era or age when roles for women were just so narrow and so prescribed. And when I say roles for women, I don't simply mean roles in film and in the entertainment industry. I mean just roles in the family life. And it was just so hard for Dorothy Dandridge to carve out both a personal and a professional life. And that ultimately leads to a certain kind of despondency, depression, mental health crisis. I mean, Dandridge wasn't alone in suffering and dying early. In the book, as you know, I talk about some of the parallels between her and Marilyn Monroe. And it seems to me no accident that young women, that ingenues of that era, could not really survive. You know, there was a hostility in the culture and in a pre-second wave feminist America, particularly 1950s America, that made it soul crushing for women and difficult for them to carve out independent professional lives and healthy personal lives. And then you add on to that for Dandridge, the whole element of racial inequity, and it made it much more difficult for her. Whereas Pam Grier and some of the others were able to find other support networks and have a lasting impression on the zeitgeist. Because I think one of the reasons Pam Grier kind of comes back is the impression she's had and made on folks who will come of age and become filmmakers like Tarantino, right? Or rap stars like Foxy Brown, right? For whom, you know, for who, folks for whom there are many homages in their work, or Snoop Dogg, right? You know, who often pays homage to Pam Grier as well. So there were a lot of younger artists that were informed by and let you know really felt an impression of their work and helped to Pam Grier has spoken about this in interviews, helped to create a renaissance for her and create a demand for her. And so it's not just in the Jackie Browns, the film directed by Quentin Tarantino, but also in Foxy Brown's personal musical homages, the rap artist Foxy Brown's sort of personal homages to Pam Grier's screen characters, for example, in her stage name, that helps create that longevity. And so I think, you know, as you move through that chronology or timeline of my book, you see that opportunities open up for women, not simply because of what's happening in the film industry, but also the society at large. And that's the kind of sort of argument I'm trying to make. Does that answer your question, though?
Yes, beautifully. Thank you so much, Prof. So I had a couple more questions, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we've discussed. You might want to revisit something we mentioned, or it might be something entirely new. Yeah? All
Sure.
right. So my
Great.
first question is, and imagine that I'm a botanist or an economic historian on a committee that's considering you for, you know, the ultimate Vassar promotion, which you probably already have,
Right. Yeah.
but imagine there's
Oh,
another.
you're so sweet.
Okay, imagine.
Right.
Well, you were modest enough not to mention you have a named chair, which is a very big deal. But in any event, imagine that you're going up for some even more elevated position. And these dudes, and they probably dudes, are scratching their heads. If they've got any hair left, they may be scratching their bald spots, whatever it is, and saying, well, she's got these famous book, she's a media personality, students love her, but you know, the inevitable question that can confront people in the humanities and the, in inverted commas, soft social sciences, how do you know what you know?
Oh, so fun, so fun. Well, thank you for that. I didn't mention my chair. You're absolutely right. Sometimes because I think, well, do people really care? But you're right. I'm very happy. I'm very proud to sit on the or to have the Mary Reapma Ross Endowed Chair there. Mary Reepma was a Vassar graduate class of 1932, who she's very proud to have gone to Vassar, and she's somebody who sponsored and was very much a benefactor of the arts, particularly cinema. There's a beautiful art house cinema named after her because she cared very much about films and film culture. So I do hold that chair and am proud of that very, I just wonder how much lay folks know about endowed chairs. But it, no, it's an honor and a pleasure. So yeah, I think that how do I know what I know? It's a great question. Part of it is just kind of like really paying attention to details and really sort of asking questions and thinking carefully rather than assuming that things are as they should be. So I don't know, I felt a long time ago before I started the Westerns book, for example, that that Western cultural idioms, country Western music, but also the Western genre was going to experience a kind of renaissance in American popular culture. For so long, film scholars in particular have been saying, oh, the Western is dead, the Western is over. Even after the assassination of JFK, we can only talk about post-Westerns because America is no longer in this age of innocence. But in point of fact, and Professor Miller, you know this well, the Western continues to undergird American popular culture. So whether we're talking about a sci-fi program like Westworld and AI technology, or environmental issues as they manifest in a TV show like Fortitude, which is set in the sort of northernmost town, or we're talking about something as campy and as funny as Cowboys versus Aliens, or we're looking at police procedural like Justified. These are programs that people will find on Netflix and Amazon and alike. The Western, the logic of the Western genre continues to inform popular culture. And I saw that and just was beginning to pay attention to it. So how do I know what I know? I just started paying attention to these curious little detail and curious coincidences. So it's about paying attention to the coincidences that keep, coming up and not just brushing them off like, oh, that means nothing. And noting those coincidences and then putting them together as a possible pattern and seeing that all of these police procedurals, all of these different programs really had a Western genre structure to them made me think like, it was one of those things that make you go, there's got to be some there. And that's what led me to just glom onto the Western and hold on and stay with it and continue to look at things carefully and closely and think about why. Why, and even though students today, you know this, I know this, our colleagues know this, many of them haven't watched a whole lot of Westerns. They don't know John Wayne, right? They don't know Henry Fonda that well. But when you start talking to them about their TV shows they watch, and you say to them, let's see, The Walking Dead, that zombie show, that's really a Westerner. When you begin to point out to them that what they're watching is really, then they're like, oh yeah, you're right. I hadn't really thought about that. And they begin to see the patterns too. And you start sharing those patterns with other people. How I know what I know is I look for the patterns. I try to trace those lines of genealogy or lineage, what evidence is for them, and then proceed like an investigator. What evidence is there to help you build that case? Or is it in your head? Because if there's not a lot of evidence, then your case will fade away. But the more you pull together these cultural strands and themes, and you look at American history, American popular culture, some of the economic practices, laws, it all begins to kind of fall into place. So that's kind of how I do my work.
Beautiful. You get the promotion, Prof. Unanimous vote.
Thank you. Thank
I
you. Right.
mean, I say this as somebody who will be unemployed as of the end of August. So, I don't say this as
Why will you be unemployed?
because that's when my contract ends and I don't have
Oh.
another job to go to. So,
Oh, okay.
that's why I have this the white male fantasy of being on high and endowing you with something.
Ah,
Because
oh, lovely.
I'm actually in some other kind of status. But in all
Right.
seriousness, thank you for that wonderful answer. And I think it also shows the importance of paying attention to narrative, how narrative recurs, and of course, how narrative appears through sound and image and so on, and not just story. Right? I mean, I think those are some of the tools that you use in your work very brilliantly. So last question, Prof, before throwing to you to add anything you want, is to ask you what's next. I mean, you've only recently finished this book, so you're allowed a little time, but what's next on the docket?
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. So I have already been contacted, actually last year, by University of New Mexico Press, because they have a new series of short monographs on Western books. And their new series is called Real West. So these are sort of like the BFI Modern Classics. And they have one on Blood on the Moon. They have one on 40 Guns, one on Thelma and Louise, interestingly enough. And they actually asked me to consider, because I pitched a number of ideas to them. They said, well, Mia, we really want you to do the one on The Harder They Come, the 1972 Jimmy Cliff film out of Jamaica, directed by Perry Henzel, that, yes, I see, hearing the music in your head,
The
that make
harder they
they
come,
come, exactly, the
the harder they
harder they
fall,
fall,
one
one
and
and
all.
all. Exactly.
Ivan. Oh my God.
Exactly. Ivan Martin, great memory, Professor Miller. So yeah, that made Jimmy Cliff an international film star and a reggae star too. It helped his career. So they've asked me to do a monograph. So I've agreed to that, and we'll see if that happens. But I mean, I fully expect that it will. I've already begun writing that, and I'm loving working on that project, because that's taking me a little bit deeper into Westerns in the Global South and having me look at Five Fingers for Marseille, the Western out of South Africa, right? And other Westerns coming out of the Global South. And I initially, as you know, in Black Rodeo, I don't discuss The Harder They Come as a Western. I look at it really a little bit more in alignment with third cinema, with films like Hour of the Furnaces and Memories of Underdevelopment and Vidas Secas and Black Girl, sort of cinemas emerging out of the sort of developing economies, or third, what we used to call third world countries, that we, as a term we don't really use anymore, but third cinema, in that it wasn't first world cinema or really European art cinema, which was for a long time called second cinema, but really third cinema coming out of the parts of the developing world. And it has, as The Harder They Come does, a kind of critique of Jamaica's subaltern status, right, in the kind of global economy through the figure of Ivan and his attempt to record. But so that was my take on it. But the press was sort of like, and this is also true in terms of James Samuel's The Harder They Fall. There is this moment in the film when the Ivan Martin character goes to the cinema and watches Django on and is inspired by the bravado of and the sort of marksmanship and the heroism of Django, in Sergio Corbucci's 1966 film Django. And many people see a lot of continuity there between The Harder They Come and other Westerns. So I'll be writing about The Harder They Come as a Western in the
And
coming
he
months.
has moments, the Jimmy Cliff character, Ivan, of imagining himself to be Clint Eastwood. Is that right? Got that right? In a Western.
Yes, and imagining himself, yeah, to be something of a gunslinger. Yes, very, very, very much the case. I also, however, and I'll be, making this case, and perhaps continuing this conversation with you, see some continuity between this film and Melina Matsoukas's Queen and Slim, because, or I would say, that there is a kind of homage in her Queen and Slim to Ivan, right? And to his whole imagination of himself, fascination of himself as a gunslinger. if you will, right? In the, in certain scenes, there are even montages in both films that look to be similar, as if Matsoukas is kind of in homage. So I really see The Harder They Come as being in dialogue with the Western, with the crime film, with third cinema, with many different
Oh, big
films.
time. And the new Apple series, or as they call it in Spain, Apple, Sugar.
Right.
I think
Ah.
Sugar owes a lot to The Harder They Come.
Okay. I have to see Sugar. What is it about?
So Colin Farrell, with a passable gringo accent,
Right.
is an LA private eye hard boiled
Okay.
and in the contemporary moment.
I
But
see.
all the way through, there are flashbacks. Well, not flashbacks, but there are diegetic and extra diegetic film noir references. Lots of Bob Mitchum,
Huh.
lots of Bogart,
Oh, wow.
Out of the Past, etc. Also, Orson Welles.
Yes.
Really powerful. And sometimes people are watching television or they're in a movie theater and these things come up. And sometimes they're just in the Colin Farrell figure's imagination as he
Huh.
drives around LA. Really, I think interesting, but because of this connection between violence and watching noir, thinking about noir, it
Yes.
makes me think about The Harder They Come a lot.
Yes, you're absolutely right to say The Harder They Come has many noir elements. Question, you know what you brought up for me that has also been on my mind a lot in terms of the omnipresence of the Western is Breaking Bad, which kind of has
Yes.
noirish elements as
Yeah.
well, right? It's one part noir, one part Western. Does Sugar have sort of some of the same tone?
I think it does. It also has, I mean, because you're a film buff, a lot as well as being an expert, you'll love moments like when people are saying, when the script, this dialogue, like, what's that movie from the late 90s with Russell Crowe set in LA in the 40s? What's it called? When someone says LA, LA, oh yeah. Confidential.
LA
So
Confidential.
it has lots of fun things like that, but I think it is obviously related to film noir, but I think the Western is there, but I just see a direct connection between the intercutting of a character's imagination of himself with Hollywood cinema as being
Yes.
very, very similar. Anyway, check it out, see what you think. Even if you don't like it, in inverted commas, I think you'll be interested. And I'm not going to tell you the twist.
Okay, don't. I will let you know,
Right?
and I'll definitely
But
watch it.
it's one of these things where a new episode is released every Friday. And so I think we're on about probably the second last, and there was a huge twist.
There you go. Oh, wow. Fabulous. I love it. I
I
can't
have no
wait.
financial interest in this series.
Okay. No, I believe you.
Anyway, Prof, so thanks for that. And I'm sure that will be a landmark book like your other three.
Oh, thank you.
Is it? I think it's three.
Well, you're right. I have the two monographs. So I have The Divas on Screen, and I have the Westerns book as the monographs, and then the two anthologies, which are the Poitier anthology and then the collection, Contemporary Black American Cinema, which came out of an NYU conference, which was a kind of a check-in on Black American cinema in the late 90s and early 2000s.
And my apologies, because I don't have a copy of that book.
That's,
And
I'll have to send you one.
I
I owe
left
you
it out.
one. I'll send you one.
Prof, I left it out of my questions. I apologize.
It's okay.
To conclude, would you like to add anything to what you've said, maybe about that book? I don't know, but over to you.
Oh, so, well, sure, thanks. So the book Contemporary Black American Cinema was published in 2012 by Routledge, and it was a collection that came out of a conference. Mancha Diawara and I organized at NYU on Black cinema to kind of update his anthology, Black American Cinema, and to kind of take an inventory or a check-in and see where is Black American cinema now, right? After films like Posse and after films like Rosewood had been made. So, in the early 2000s, and the book came out in 2012. And I'm just happy to say that I love the contributors' work. We have a piece in there by Ed Guerrero and on Bamboozled, which graces the cover of the book. We have a piece by Charlie Musser on early cinema. We have Paula Massoud's wonderful work in there, Keith Harris, Michael Gillespie, and a range of folks. So that was a really fun project to pull together. But actually, Professor Miller, I wanted to ask you, as my closing question, what's your favorite movie or TV show these days? Well, really, I'm streaming so much on TV. I want to know more about what you're streaming.
God, I am. This is definitely guilty pleasure time.
Okay.
Okay.
That's TV watching.
That's TV watching.
Right.
And it's a French policier.
Oh.
It's on Apple here in Spain, but I don't know what else. I don't know what it's on in the United States. Candice Renoir. Renoir,
Okay.
like the painter. And she is a blonde sort of police chief.
Okay.
Single mom, four children, and she is painted as idiosyncratic and difficult
Okay.
by her male colleagues. She sleeps with men she shouldn't really sleep with.
Happens.
It happens. She has lots of fun. She has, as one of her close associates, a French Arab guy from Morocco. It's set
Oh.
in the south of France, so there are lots of mixed race and immigrant questions and prejudices, which she
Okay.
doesn't have,
Okay.
or at least not overtly, let's say. And I think
Right.
that it has lots of twists and turns,
Okay.
and the struggle to be a professional woman and be sexy and desirable and be happy
Yeah.
is, I think, not that I would know, but I think it's well, really well brought out. And I am binging. In fact, I've got about half an hour after we finish before my next podcast taping. I
Ah.
think I can knock off, I think I can knock off the episode I was watching when we started talking, Prof.
Oh, that's hilarious. I'm so glad to know that you binge watch TV shows.
So it's Condi for listeners. Forgive my accent. It's Condi, as in Candice Bergen,
Yes.
right? And Renoir, like the sculptor, the da 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 da.
Oh.
So really interesting, and it's set, pardon the pun, in Sète, this absolutely gorgeous southern French beach town where I have actually spent time. I suspect, Prof, and if you watch it, I'd love to get your take on this. The actors probably are all very Parisian, and there's a second unit that spends vast amounts of time taking spectacular exterior shots of the set beaches and whatnot. And then miraculously, it's raining all the time and dreary and very urban when the
Okay.
actors are more in shot. And I think
Okay.
that's them saying, I'm not fucking leaving Paris. What do you mean by not going to the boonies? You know
That's
what I mean?
great. Okay.
Until they decide, actually, it's kind of cold and wet here. Maybe I will go down there. So it's a sort of, you know what I mean?
No, that's great.
So I think it's at least interesting, and something to watch. So thank you so much, Prof. Since we first met very many years ago, I've always learned from you, and I've learned from reading your work. And today I've learned an enormous amount from talking to you. And I'm sorry, I am not giving up on The Harder They Come book. It
Okay.
ha You said it'll probably happen. It has to happen. Your
Thank
readers cannot wait.
you. I so appreciate that. And thank you so much for interviewing me today. This was really fun. I'm going to give you one parting show that I loved.
Yep.
Or one message before we go, which is The Gentlemen, which is a TV show that I streamed. Have you seen The Gentlemen?
I haven't. I have
Oh.
it available, but I haven't watched it.
Oh, okay. I'll be curious to know what you think of it because it's got Giancarlo Esposito, who I love. It's Guy Ritchie, who seems to really have matured a bit and developed
I
and
hope so.
No, it's very funny and makes fun of the British aristocracy. So too many fun things right
Oh,
there.
yeah.
But
Actually, one season of Candice Renoir, they got a kid to direct it who clearly is a Guy Ritchie devotee.
okay,
So
okay, okay.
interesting. Thank you so much, Prof. I'll watch the gentleman now.
Thanks so much, Toby. Take care.